Kia ora tātou, good afternoon, it's good to see you all, and Joe Holland, the Chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and the Engineer Charitable Trust, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all today to this particular monthly midday military history presentation. This month is New Zealand Land Wars Month, observed now on the 28th of October. So what we thought we would do is commemorate that with a presentation on what is pretty much the last campaign in the land wars, and that was Te Kuhi's War from 1868 to 1872. So without further ado, I will welcome Peter Whipp, who I'm sure you all know, seeing as a very regular presenter, and we're very pleased to actually have him be able to present to us, because these are topics that he knows extremely well. And I'll let you explain the battlefield tour that you've just been running too. So without further ado, please welcome Peter.
Kia ora everyone, thank you all for coming along, and thank you for the introduction, Joe. As Joe just mentioned, freshly back off a battlefield tour. So my job, one of the better ones in the Army, a good one in the Army, is to take members of the Defence Force, Army, Navy, Air Force, regular reserves and civil staff on tours of New Zealand's battlefields. And the last one that we've created, and the first time we've run it, just concluded. In fact, I think in the next half an hour they'll be walking down off Tiberiti. On Monday we left from Wairu, we retraced the steps of the Ngāti Kuhinungu down to Hawke's Bay. We trekked around towards Gisborne, but stopped at a farm and trekked through the bush, got to Te Kuhi's landing place at Whare Ongaonga. That was a long day, we all slept well that night. Next day we're at Matawhero, and then we drove up to Ngātapa, and after that huge drive, got back last night to Wairu again, and even driving the Waiweke Gorge, where Te Kuhi and all those that were trying to track him down, and along with the families, I might say, that were accompanying Te Kuhi, it would have been a hell of a trek in their day. It's a hell of a drive. I believe it's a pretty mean flight too, if you're in a Skyhawk, but no, it would have been somewhat easier and shorter too, I can say. But so we're just sort of doing that tour. I think I've mentioned to some of you before, inside the Defence Force, we like to take our people, because they come from all over New Zealand, and some of them have enlisted they've come from other countries, they're now New Zealanders, and it gives everybody a grounding. And the most common comments we get are that, oh, we didn't even know this existed, and yet we've been here before, or all the sources that we read contradict. So that's history, isn't it? Anyway. So I just get on with the presentation. I'm going to talk about Te Kuhi's War. I mean, I think the correct Māori te reo would be Te Kuhi, which is a Māori version of the name, the English name he took of Coates. So quite a lot of people will say Te Kuhi, but it doesn't matter, but more correctly, Te Kuhi. The last and longest of the campaigns. I just want to situate Te Kuhi's war or campaign. It really occurred at the end of the period that we know as the New Zealand Wars. So we had the Warring Forties, Ruapekapeka and all of those, and Wellington and Whanganui. Then we had that period where the predominant government forces were imperial troops and sailors. So we had 10 to 12,000 British troops and sailors too, through to the end of the period where Cameron and then Chute were in South Taranaki. But then all the British troops left. So for the period of Te Takawaru and Te Kuhi, we're now talking about the predominant forces for the Crown being either, well, colonial forces being mainly Pākehā, who have sometimes served in the British forces or not, or been born in New Zealand or come from another thing, but they've been raised and they're being paid by the New Zealand government, and also large numbers of kūpapa, Māori, Ngāti Porou, Whanganui and others on the side of the government for that campaign. And so as we go through, you'll realise that towards the end, there were more Māori pursuing Te Kōti than there were Europeans. And then I tend to underline the wars after Te Kōti. Others will argue that probably Parihaka could be included. But it's probably the last tour that I'll try and organise because it's actually a really good campaign. We've got our own Gandhi, only three of them, and that would be a nice one to open up and take people to perhaps next year and maybe even talk about it at a future time. The thing, we know, I look at those pictures, though, I've just put up the leaders of everything from Tita Koro and before his time, and they're all rangatira. Te Rauparaha, Honeheke, Wiramu Kingi, of course, the Kingi Tanga himself, and Tita Kawaro even, they were rangatira, highborn. But so why is it then that this man, who's not of high birth, was able to galvanise people from many different iwi and lead them on a campaign for so long? So it raises a number of questions. I might not quite answer all of them as we go, but who was he and how did he emerge as a war leader? Why did he take on the authorities in the first place? Why was he at large for so long? And then, as I've alluded to, why was he hunted by Māori and Pākehā alike? Why was he parted? And what might his legacy be? The little picture there is the advertisement for New Zealand's first docudrama. It was a silent movie, the Te Kōti Trail. And it's a bit sensational, stopped by this film censor. It was actually just stopped for release so that the Tangata Whenua could have a look at it first before it was released. But I think they went stopped by the film censor to try and get some interest in it. And probably can get it on YouTube, but I haven't actually had a good look for it, so I'm not entirely sure. So who was Te Kōti, the man? So full name, Te Kōti Arikirangi Te Tiroki. But as I mentioned before, the Te Kōti piece was his English sort of the name he'd taken. He had a lot of contact with Europeans in the Gisborne era. He went to church school, knew the Bible, particularly the Old Testament. I think he was a very intelligent individual to, you know, read, write, memorise things. He was a supercargo on a ship. That meant he bought and sold goods between Gisborne and Auckland. And also, I think, traded a little bit on the side. And that also made enemies with some of the local Europeans who were themselves traders in the Tauranga, in the Gisborne era, Tauranga, Gisborne area. He had, when Paimariri came around, and especially when it swept up into the east coast, he did not take that up. In fact, he was fighting alongside Europeans and on a couple of occasions was accused of aiding the enemy, the Hoho, the Paimariri people, and passing of ammunition, passing of information, that sort of thing. But he was the first time he was released, no evidence, and the second time he was not released. Again, no particular evidence was put forward. He was not tried. And then when you look through, you probably factor in that he had three groups working against him. One group would have been those storekeepers, mainly Europeans, who saw him as probably the opposition. Then there were people like the local militia commander and magistrate who probably had his eyes on some of Te Kōti's land. And that was one motivation. But for some of the rangatira, from even his own iwi, he was an upstart. So he'd always annoyed them, pissed them off. He'd done a whole, there was a whole lot of things. He would, if he was your son. But he got himself a name as a troublemaker. And so I think all three groups, the second time he was arrested, it coincided with a couple of hundred Paimariri that they'd captured. They didn't know what to do with them, so they put them on a ship and they sent them off to the Chatham Islands, and he went with them. He tried to protest his innocence, where are the charges, etc., etc. No one would hear anything of it, and he was basically told to get on the boat. And so he, along with all the Paemariri, went out to the Chatham Islands. There were people out there, Maori and some Europeans, but a sort of a penal colony, for want of a better word, was established, and they were there for 2 years. And they were told, they never really knew when they were going to be released, no charges laid, they were just out there, pretty difficult living conditions. And in that time, Te Kōti had like a tubercular fever. He was seeing, you know, visions and that, and studying the Bible, and he said he had messages from God, if you like, and directions, and he started to develop the ringatū, or raised hand faith. And at about the time when before the prison guards were reduced, they'd sent pretty much all of the rangatira back to the mainland, so he was left behind. This provided the opportunity for him to become the de facto kind of leader of the prisoners, the large number of prisoners that were left behind. European authorities did an inspection of the thing, and because the guards were, half of them were drunk and disorderly, they actually removed and they lowered the numbers of guards down, and this provided an opportunity for Te Kōti to think about how they might make their escape. And indeed, one of his tricks was, well, I don't know if it was a trick, but one of the things he did was predicted the arrival of a number of ships that might deliver them back to the mainland, and lo and behold, they did arrive. But he probably, cynical me, he would have learned about that through his knowledge, just even listening to the guards and that sort of thing. But anyway, he came up with a very cunning and detailed plan of how to ensure that members of the island out at the Chathams, who weren't involved in the prison community, didn't find out what was going on. And then when those ships came in, they quickly, through trickery, subdued the few guards that were there, took the armory and the guardhouse, got the keys and all of that. And then he, with his sailing background and knowing how to operate a whaleboat, he was part of the group that went out and they took over the two ships. And particularly this ship, the Rifleman, the three-master that you see there, that was going to be their deliverance back to the promised land, back to the New Zealand mainland. And so, having subdued the guards, given instructions that no one was to be killed, they basically boarded the ship and set sail for the mainland, a couple of hundred kilometres away. And you can see the numbers there. They're quite substantial numbers of people that are crowded onto that ship, along with lots of firearms, ammunition, some gold, some money, there's a whole, and food, a whole lot of stuff. That thing must have been packed. They set sail on the 4th, didn't get very far for the first few days. And this is when, you know, another little aspect of Te Kōti's controversial sort of life during this period. He decided, or he said to everybody, that the reason they weren't making headway was because there was a Jonah on board. And the Jonah happened to be his uncle, who was a sceptic about some of his prophecies and the tricks that he was playing in the church and all that sort of stuff, and openly deriding him. And also was thought to have tried to tip off the guards that something was up, although he wasn't listened to, so they just dumped him over the side. Yeah. Anyway, and maybe as a sailor he knew that the weather was going to change, but they certainly made their way, and they landed in a little isolated bay south of his area, so just south of Gisborne and the Whareonga area there. And at that point, eventually the authorities came to know that he'd landed. They gave instructions that he was to remain where he was. No. And so he started to head inland, and you can see things start to deteriorate from there. I've just put in the little thing to Matawhero. Some of you may know of it because of the wines, if you've been into that region, but there's a bit more notoriety, and we'll get to that in a moment. So a landing has taken place. I'm not going to cover absolutely everything in sort of detail. There was a few stoushes in which Te Kōti, basically knowing the land and knowing what the colonial forces and the Maori would do and where they would go, outsmarted them and got more rifles, more food, more ammunition, and even a few horses. So this is, you're seeing a whole lot of things that mark out his style, you know, as probably more of a guerrilla leader than a conventional fighter. So I've titled this one sort of setting the tone, because one of the events that took place early on in the campaign was that Te Kōti launched a surprise raid into the Matawhero area. You could argue it wasn't necessarily a surprise. People had been tipped off, but some of the local commanders, like Biggs, decided to not take that advice and go with other things. But in the dead of night, 100 warriors came into the Matawhero area, where many of the Europeans and some Maori were living, but they weren't like in a village that was going to be, that's Gisborne or Turanga, where there might have been 100 or so Europeans, but at least 50 of them, men, women and children, and many of the men were militia officers. They were living in little farmlets and isolated farmhouses. So Te Kōti and his men snuck in, and then in the dead of night, many were stabbed, tomahawked, you know, bayoneted, and then because some were shot, eventually the word started to get out, and so some people had miraculous escapes. And if you want a good idea of what an escape might be like, read Dave Hayward's book. Sort of tracks through one of those quite nicely in the story there. But terrorised the people. Those that survived all fled into Gisborne, where there was a redoubt. And so for the next couple of days, Te Kōti and his people were able to pretty much lay waste to that whole area, get a lot more ammunition, a lot more firearms, because all the militiamen and everyone had their stash of firearms. They got animals, food, all that sort of thing. But this is a defining moment. It's almost a kind of a Gaza-Israel kind of moment, if you think about it. The sheer violence on a scale not before, and it certainly galvanised people against him, including people from his own iwi and other iwi as well, who were also incensed by that action. So quite a lot of people killed and wounded, probably about 50% Maori, 50% Pākehā. You know, this is probably his utu for land taken and for being imprisoned for a couple of years in what he would at least say were unfounded reasons, because he never really had a chance to prove his innocence. But it was a horrific thing there, and Major Reginald Biggs, who was instrumental in having him sent without trial to the Chathams, was also the local magistrate and was also the local militia force commander, was killed along with his wife and very young child, and so were a lot of other family members. There were some miraculous escapes, but there was some horrendous killing and destruction. So really for the next 4 years, Te Kōti was on the run, and I only put that map in there because it just shows the extent of the terrain that he traversed over the period of time. Now I just, as I mentioned earlier, just drove that piece that goes to the north, but going through the Uruweras on foot, even today, is a huge challenge. So he's backwards and forwards across the central and eastern part of the North Island. Out on the west there in the Kingitanga, where you can actually see the little bits of blue, that's the Kawhia Harbour. So that's how far west he's going and all his tricks. All the crosses are engagements, main engagements, but the orange areas are where he stays for extended periods, such as they were, where he gets sanctuary, tries to hide out when he can in the forest, and also from there he undertakes raids in different directions. So very hard to box him in when he's in a kind of a central position, because he could go in any direction. And as he proved at Matawhero, he's very well versed at spreading the indications that he's going this way, but actually he ends up going that way, and that he just, there's not enough force to basically to trap him there. a little bit about his campaign and style. So it was a war of movement. He crisscrossed that central and eastern North Island and taking occasional periods of refuge. I think initially he wanted to get into the king country. Firstly, I think he wanted to challenge the Maori king, and then later on he wanted sanctuary in that area, but he didn't get either of those until right towards the end. But that central position meant, as I said, he could rest up a little bit. It would be very difficult, as Evan Torrance will know, as Dave Hayward knows. It's hard enough to find your own people in the jungle, let alone to track down and find a terrorist, a guerrilla, or another opposition force. So he would feel relatively safe in those sanctuaries. But also, they seem to be places where others would join him. And so in each of those locations, he was able to replace losses in not only arms and equipment, but also warriors, and build his force back up again. So it was important that he had some sort of sanctuary. So raiding, ambushing, killing, you know, not just Maori or Pakeha opponents of him, you know, soldiers or kupapa, but children, women, use of surprise, you might argue terror in the current thing in some of them, you know, attacking deliberately large groups of civilians. So more of a guerrilla than anything else. And he would either plunder or be given stuff through neutral tribes, or sometimes occasionally there will be a little bit of coercion involved. He eventually gets sanctuary in the king country right towards the end there. So I'm just going to go through two of the major operations where there was the potential to actually catch him and probably kill him. But in both cases, he manages to escape. This one's Natapa. I don't know if the technology works. Yeah, we're going to climb Natapa. It's a massive hill with a pancake or pizza-shaped top, near vertical sides. But because it's landing, we couldn't do that. Thank you. So just there, I'll let Jamie Bellich sort of just introduce it a little bit. I'll just leave it at that. It's only a glimpse, but it's a lot easier than taking you all there. Right, so, yep, that's come back. Thanks. Thanks, Tracy. So this large position, as you can see, probably from the photograph, the image down lower left, near vertical sides, the par itself, the red piece, and on the diagram looking down, bird's eye view, the sketch map made shortly after the battle, that's where the par was. Three lines of stockade, and in the sketch diagram to the right, you can see three lines of stockades, some entrenchments, all that sort of thing, cliffs on the two angular sides, and down the back, where the yellow line is, I've walked that, well, no, I haven't walked it, I've been to it, I'm too scared to walk down it. It's less than a metre wide. Fortunately, there's some brave fence has put a fence down it, so you could, I guess, if you were crazy, go down it, but it's really steep. And so, I guess the Kauri thought it would be very easy to defend, and for the first attempt on it, he was able to hold off the attackers. So the attacking forces were unable to penetrate through the base heading is the way you're looking at from left to right to get up to the palisades. But Rōpata, the Ngāti Porou leader, plus a Captain Priest and a few others were able to scramble around to the far side or the top side of the diagram or the opposite side to what you're looking at there in the image, and they were able to shimmy up a crevice, get up to the top to where the trenches were, and then by passing up loaded weapons to the top, Rōpata was able to start firing into the position. But on his own, and perhaps with Captain Priest, that wasn't enough people to do anything. And as they started to run low of ammunition, Priest got sent away to pick up more Ngāti Porou, and they elected not to come forward to support him. So Rōpata and Priest came back down the hill, and in disgust, Rōpapa took his people back to their rohi, to their land, and sacked them all, and got a new force going, which he brought in, and that's why the second phase of the battle started on the 31st of December. So, in the meantime, Te Kōti had pushed out his defences. So, on the left of screen, you see all the pink bits. They're actually the sapping that the attackers have now had to do, because Te Kōti's defences have come somewhat forward, and so he's made that front area a bit of a killing ground. So, Colonel McDonnell decides that he's going to besiege the position whilst they do the sapping, and he places divisions of the armed constabulary around the different parts, and you might see the names Robertson, Fraser's is the yellow group over the back holding that back bridge, but there is a bit of a blind spot, and so the black marks there are basically where on the night of the 4th, 5th January, in a massive storm, Te Kōti and all his followers, other than those that were injured, basically abseiled their way down a near vertical rock face down into the bush below to make their escape. And then rather than going out as one group, they split into many little groups so as to confound the follow-up. So in the morning, just as an attack was about to be launched, it was discovered that the position was basically empty, other than a few wounded, some dead, and Rōpapa immediately launched follow-up groups to try and track them all down, and rather than keep his contingent in a large one, he also split them up into small parties, and they rounded up and brought back at least 120 Rangatū from the position, brought them back. They were taken up to the top of the cliff and then just shot and tumbled back over the cliff. Now, many of them were bona fide fighters and supporters of Te Kōti, but probably some of them were those who he had captured and compelled to be part of the defence. So there was no, are you or are you not? It was just, they killed off the lot of them. It's controversial, obviously, and the presence of Pākehā and therefore government representatives there who didn't interfere, it means that nowadays, sometimes when people look back, they kind of blame them for what happened. But back then, especially for Rōpapa and others, what Te Kōti's people had done to their people in places like Matawhero and elsewhere, this is the punishment, this was utu for that, which was perhaps utu. So, you know, it's complicated, but a lot of those that escaped were rounded up. Te Kōti wasn't one of those rounded up, but for a while it was thought, though, he may have just been wounded perhaps and died somewhere out in the bush, but lo and behold, he and others managed to regroup back in the Uruwetas. So when Te Kōti was in the Uruwetas, it was going to be really difficult to hunt him down. As I've mentioned, it's really hard to find your opposition. So the strategy that was decided upon was that columns of armed constabulary and kūpapa would go into Tūhoe country, whereupon they were every kāinga, every crop, every animal they found was going to be killed or burnt or destroyed. And so that was kind of a scorched earth. And the idea was that although you probably wouldn't be able to find and kill Te Kōti or round up his people or him, hopefully he would outstay his welcome, and if he broke out, he would probably head in the general direction of the Kingitanga and the King Country. And actually, this is what happened. There was such destruction of Tūhoe livelihood. I mean, they don't have wide open fields where they can plant their crops. I think we talk about small sun-facing clearings on different parts of hills and valleys that they know. If you find enough of those and burn and slash and destroy those and free animals and collapse or burn fuddies, you're basically going to starve them. And so Te Kōti ended up breaking out of the uruwetas. He bumped into an opepe, a cavalry militia group who were at ease, and many of them were killed. More horses, more ammunition, more rifles obtained. And he made his way south through a number of actions down to the area of Tipuriri. And there are other battles in there, Turanga Taupo and the Tipunanga Saddle. I'm not going to go into the detail of those, because I think the next major battle that I want to talk about would be Tipuriri. But I just, before we get to the battle itself, I just want to show you this map, because this shows the movement of Kupapa contingents into the central North Island in order to hopefully, now that he's out in the open, to be able to trap and deal with Te Kōti. So Ngāti Kuhunumu come up the what we now know as the Taupō Napier Road, and another lot came up the Gentle Annies, tracked through what we now know as the Army Training Area, which always amazes them that they had the group come through there, picked up some of the local iwi, the Whanganui's under Major Kemp, walk it up as far as they could get, and then they walked their way up, came in through the Rangipo Desert, again part of the training area, and they got up to Macdonnell's Redoubt around the Potu kind of area just south of Turangi, and a group of Arawa came down from the north. So you actually had the assembly of a large force that's primarily going to be made up of Maori rather than Europeans. So here you see a modern day aerial shot of the redoubt. So rather than build a gunfighter type pa, Te Kōti chose, his people chose to build something that resembled a European redoubt. That is to say, a square or rectangular earthen based defensive position with a high wall on the inside and a trench right round the outside, a big ditch. And you'll see the lugs or the at each end, the bastions, they were designed there so that the fires and the bastion could make sure that anybody who got into the ditch would also be shot rather than being able to either climb over the walls or collapse the walls and break into the redoubt itself. But it wasn't constructed as well as it might have been. Certainly the location was pretty good. If I just show you now, this is the kind of view that they would have had in the day. So from the par itself, extremely long lines of fire, so the muskets they had, some of the rifles they captured, they would have been able to knock down the attacking forces at fairly long range. Except that there were some faults in the design. One of the faults, well, that's the direction of the attack. I'll just go back now to the thing. I guess one of the faults in the big picture was that Te Kōti and his people, the only other opportunity they'd had to defend in some sort of strength was at Ngātapa. And Ngātapa took a couple of days to build up, and then they had another go, and that took a few days. They pounded them with mortars, they put in the siege groups, they did all of that. This thing was over in hours. And I think what happened was that the attacking forces moved so quickly on such a broad front that they were able to get into those ditches on the right-hand side of the aerial photograph that you see there. And from there, they were able to do such things as sometimes they just pulled the musket through the slot, the firing slot, out of the hands of the defending warrior. Or they got pumice and blocked up the firing loops. They started digging away to try and collapse the wall. Some of the braver ones actually managed to climb up and shoot down into the thing there. All they were trying to do was break in some way and get it to Kōti's people. But just on that, just to the left and down a bit from the white cross that I'm showing there, that's a modern day viewing stand, but just forward of that is the exit point. And Te Kōti was actually able to, at the last minute, escape through that gap with some of his people. And many of the warriors that weren't already dead were able to get out. And so the last part of the fighting was actually undertaken by the women who were also defending the redoubt. And there was a lot of vigorous fighting going on hand to hand with basically women fighting against mainly Maori but occasional Europeans inside of the redoubt itself. Te Kōti, even this time, managed to get away, although he was wounded yet again. And possibly if afterwards they'd done a more determined sweep of the area, they may have picked him up before he again was able to get away with other of his people were able to escape and then regroup, etc., etc. And there's another couple of years of fighting after this. And you just see here, so with about 300 warriors, he's nearly faced off at 2-1 there. The armed constabulary of about 100, so that's 20% of the overall force. The rest is made up of various tribal groups. And I rather think one of the reasons the attack went off so quickly was that each of those tribal groups was trying to outdo the other. And it just gave them some added impetus to get there quickly. And I think it's the speed of this that really undid the garrison. The other thing was the angles weren't done correctly, so if they even could fire out down into the ditch, they were unable to. And the way the firing slots were done, they couldn't depress the weapons down. So there were lots of different faults in the position. So it really kind of demonstrates that whilst Te Kōti and his people were really good at this sort of hit-and-run guerrilla-type stuff, makes it difficult to trap them, where we in a conventional sense might go into defence as a way of, with smaller numbers, creating greater destruction, this became a trap for them. But Te Kōti had 9 lives at least and was able to get away yet again. Done that one. All right. So how and why was he able to survive for so long? So, you know, what was his thinking? How did he get people to fight? How did he actually enable them to fight? So, you know, he didn't have proper military training, so he wasn't bound by any tradition or training or drills. He was just, I think, there, totally unpredictable where he might strike. And then that was also enhanced by the fact that he deliberately sowed misinformation about where he might strike and he would go in another direction. I think he drew a lot of inspiration from and then used a lot of the Old Testament, you know, the situation of the Israelites, the promised land, and that was tied into the return of Maori land to them, and so that kind of helped. I think he positioned his own revenge inside the wider campaign of the return of land, but we do know he had considerable planning skills. Even if some of the detail, like at Tipperiri, was not that flash, he certainly knew how to plan whether they be raids to get a particular armoury for a certain town to get that ammunition, all the way through to much larger actions like at Matawhero. How did he get him to fight? Well, he used to make predictions. Oh, the archangels will come and, you know, we'll be able to go back to New Zealand and, you know, stuff. You know, there were things that he was able to do. He had phosphor that he'd sort of put on his hands, a little trick I think he learned off some of his sailor mates, and sort of in the dark of the whare, this hand would slowly float up and he had a cross that, you know, would be towed up on it. I mean, he had sort of trickery and stuff like that he'd play, but this, you know, he played on the sort of the psychology of all of that. I think there was a climate of fear, not just of him by Europeans and stuff, but sometimes within his own group, that you know, if you didn't agree with him, you probably weren't going to say it, or you might be the next Jonah, that sort of thing. And so many people felt compelled. He didn't really have that many desertions, but nevertheless, I think many felt compelled. Certainly he was a bit of a, he was a showman, an orator. You know, and we know, even in the modern context, what leaders with showman type skills and, you know, the great orator, you know, good and bad stuff can actually happen as a result. I think the Old Testament, some of the Psalms, the wording of the Psalms in Te Reo, really just resonated with the Maori, and, you know, some of them were even chanted whilst they were killing. And there's a small element, and they would, and his people wouldn't be alone in this, who just the extreme violence of some of it just appealed to it. So there's always going to be an element there. What about the physical side of it? So by keeping moving, not having to defend a permanent base and therefore have an objective that could be attacked or cut off, that enabled him freedom there. He had alliances with Tūhoe. All the raiding I've already talked about to get ammunition and food and horses and all of that. Apart from the two examples I've given you, he basically avoided set piece battles to minimise the chance of being destroyed in detail. But also he made up the numbers. He constantly, no matter if he lost or won, he was always drawing recruits. People were always, whether it be just the opportunity to fight, whether they believed that he would be the saviour and all the rest of it, people just kept moving into his organisation and building up his numbers. Right towards the end, though, and he'd been trying to work, I mean, how do you end these things? There are many conflicts going along today, you know. Did a certain Russian leader think his war would be going on for so long? I mean, how do you end stuff in the Middle East? So how could Tukorti end it? I think what he was hoping for, after thinking he might usurp the Kingitanga, was perhaps to have sanctuary there. But the Kingitanga was not going to have anything of that initially, but eventually he allowed him to move into the king country, the Kingitanga area. But he didn't sort of befriend him. I mean, you're in, but you're in for a purpose, and that's just to let things calm down, rather than the fact that you've been forgiven or that I agree with your methods. This would be from the Kingitanga perspective. So when he was pardoned, I think a lot of people assumed that meant he was not guilty of anything, or he'd been forgiven, or that he was owed an apology. But really, a pardon is just, as it says there, it's a political decision, just basically saying, no matter what you've done, we've just decided there's not going to be any particular consequences. So he wasn't forgiven for anything. It was just that they decided they wouldn't pursue him after all. And I think part of the reasoning there was they wanted to open up the king country for the railways, for roading and all of that sort of thing. So you really had to make sure that this fellow wasn't going to spark up and interdict it. So he was actually pardoned. And that didn't go down very well with a lot of people, particularly even in the Gisborne area. There were many people were upset with that. Of his legacy, well, while he was in the king country, before the pardon, then certainly after the pardon, he did a lot of movement around with people and developed his Ringatū faith. The prayers, the psalms and all the rest of it he built up, and he converted a lot of people across to his religion. And perhaps even a bit like Tita Kawaru, eventually he came down to the idea that you know, you weren't going to win this thing by fighting. You had to win it through argument, persuasion, you know, forgiveness, all that sort of thing. So it was quite a different spin on it. But his church still survives. So 16,000. I know the numbers look a lot smaller 12 years later, but in that census, the numbers in all religions have dropped. So what it's still suggesting is there are definitely followers out there of the Ringatū religion. And I think, to almost close off, there'll be another one of these attempts, Tracy, to I'll leave sort of the last word on Ringatū to one of their leaders. All right, so there's a little bit there. I mean, so the church is alive, smallish sort of numbers compared to other religions, but certainly that's a big group there still following Te Kōti's original teachings. Just a few thoughts before I close off then. The unpredictability of him, from where he might be and exactly what he was going to do, was he even still alive, etc., etc., meant it was very difficult for the colonial forces, and by that I include Kupapa as well as European members there, and therefore they tended to be reactive, especially in the early stages. He moved so quickly and with such violence that there was a lot of shock amongst Maori and Pakeha alike there for when that was done. The fact that he was always in broken terrain and mostly in the areas of sanctuary made it even more difficult to locate him. We certainly know that he was weakest on the conventional side of warfare and more vulnerable in the open rather than out in the close country. And another thing, and I think I talked last year about Te Kawaru, so what I haven't basically covered here was that quite coincidentally, just after Te Kawaru got started, Te Kōti sprung up on the other coast, and so the government and the colonial forces were basically having to deal with one, then the other, then the other, and they were transferring forces, and indeed between MacDonnell and Whitmore they were even being changed as the commander, as one either got ill or was sacked for some failure, the other one would take over, and they basically went backwards and forwards like that for a while, but it certainly was a distraction. But I think there's a lot of luck in there. I'm not putting everything down to luck at all, because he was a very good guerrilla type leader and all the rest of it. You might not have agreed with his methods and all that sort of thing, but he was certainly that. But being wounded a number of times, all those lucky escapes he had, he certainly had luck on his side, I'll give him that. So I think at just about time now, I'm more than happy to take questions. Oh, no, there's one last thing I've got to do. I know history can be, I mean, Cowan is still very good to read on Te Kawaru and Te Kōti. James Belich as well is good to read, even though those two, 1921 and sort of 1980. I like some of the faction though. So Morris Shadbolt's Season of the Jew is a goodie, and so is Dave Haywood's Chasing the Ghost, which is only, it's fairly recently published. But I think the title of these two kind of summarise it, the Jew Old Testament sort of thing, but also the ghost. How do you track this guy and his people down? So, but both of them in themselves are good reads and recommended. And then lastly, Ron Crosby, and I can't really talk about the book because I'm only sort of 15 or 20 pages in, but he's basically written about the last stages of Te Kōti's time before he got sanctuary, and essentially Te Kōti has abducted a couple of hundred members of the Whakatohia community near Opotiki and taken them back into the bush. They were eventually released, and their release was attributed to the Ngāti Porou, mainly because of Captain Porter, who was with them, later Colonel, probably wrote up their involvement. But it seems that in this case anyway, with Ron Crosby the lawyer doing the forensics, the real kudos goes to Kemp and the Whanganui's. But it's an interesting read about Te Kōti, and the pictures in there of Crosby and Co in the bush show you even today just how difficult that Tūhoe country still is and what it might have been like. But anyway, I just wanted to finish off with a couple of the references, and fully acknowledging though that I haven't read this one, but I've had a look through, and it would be a good one to get hold of. Okay.
Excellent.
Any questions?
Questions?
Where did he die?
After he got sanctuary, it was kind of like, and then was pardoned, the idea was that he wouldn't then go back to war, and nor would he go back to Gisborne. But he wanted to go back to Gisborne, and none of the people there wanted him back at all. They weren't going to have a bar of this, and they petitioned for him, the government, to stop him. So the end result was they gave him some land in the Ohiwa Harbour area near Opotiki, and whilst travelling there or there, he had an accident with a cart, I think, and that he was injured and then later died of his injuries. So he was up in Ohiwa.
Did you go to Ohiwa this time?
We drove past, but then suddenly ended up down in Galatea. But I'm going to add it to the tour because it is a significant spot in of its own right. Just like Whakatauhia, the people there, I think we'll stop somewhere in the Waiweka Gorge and we might talk about that, but I didn't feel I was in a position to do so either at this talk or on the recent tour till I've read the book and we could describe a little bit more about what went on. It's a fascinating thing, you know, abducting a couple of hundred people.
Yeah. How old was he then?
He's got up into his, he would have been 50s because he dies when he's in about his 70s, some sort of 20 years later. I mean, you know, stopping around the bush as I was in my 30s and 40s was hard enough, but I can imagine, you know, another 20 years on, it gets a bit harder. Good old Ron Crosby, you know, doing the yards. Yeah.
It fascinates me how people got around in those days, of course. How did they recruit an army from so far away or so many different areas? How long does that take? They've got to walk to help people pay. You need to come back and it takes a long time. You mentioned horses a few times.
Yeah. Well, he wouldn't be doing it like that. I think in Maori Dimon, it's not just here, but there's a network of information that's passed. So even when, say, the Whanganui's were coming down to do a raid into the Hutt Valley, and it would have taken at least a week for someone to walk up there, another week or so to assemble forces, and a week to come down, the fact that you're moving through all these different rohi, getting permission to go into that area, the word gets out and people just talk to their relatives in that one, and there's kind of a network of information, kind of like a human intelligence one, and I think the word would go out about his successes and people would probably be drawn to him as much as they would be recruited. A lot of the active recruitment would have occurred in a village that they went to, or, you know, maybe even captured people and almost pressed them into service. So and then emissaries would go out and draw people back in. Tukorti himself and his scouts made huge use of horses, probably more so than any other organisation other than the Colonial Defence Force Cavalry. So he himself sometimes, but he had scouts that could move great distances quite quickly on horseback and then bring back information. So the mobility.
There were a lot of horses in that
invasion. Yes, he got 150 of them off the Ngāti Kuanungu down at Tauranga Taupo. Yeah. Down near. Yeah, he tried to attack them, it didn't work, and a witness to the failed attack was Rewe Maniapoto, so he decided Te Kōti wasn't such a great fighter after all, so went back to the King Country. But he could certainly raid and stuff like that.
Any other questions? No? That was fantastic, Peter. I mean, it just goes to show the depth of our own history. And the complexity of it all, it really is quite amazing, really, about what we don't know. The old story about you don't know what you don't know. But I'm hoping that, you know, if we get these presentations going like this, that we'll get a series of, or a better understanding of some of our early history. And given the fact that, you know, while this was going on in the North Island, the rest of New Zealand was operating, you know, when you think about the militia and the engineer volunteers from around 1865 right the way through to the late 1800s, and yet this is quite an interesting sort of period where the last sort of, you know, campaign was operating right up to Parahaka in 1881. And once again, thank you, Peter.